MacCast, Sunday, January 28th, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. I'm going to be right up front and be honest with you. This is the third time I've recorded this intro. I don't know what's going on tonight. We may be in for a little bit of a rough ride in this episode. I'm going to do my best, but things seem to be a little off. How are you doing? I hope you're doing better than I am. Anyway, want to let you know we got a number of cool things to talk about in this episode. We're going to be getting into the iPhone X and trying to analyze, is it a success or a disappointment? There's arguments in both directions, and we're going to be talking about some of those, what analysts are saying, and just what I think, of course, as well. We're going to talk about the HomePod, the sound of its imminent arrival. It's right around the corner, and we know a lot more details about HomePod and its features. I'm going to find out who ordered one. Maybe you did. Maybe I did. We'll find out in this episode. A bunch of OS betas came out this week, and there's a bunch of cool new features and hints of features to come in those. We'll get into that. And then we have a bunch of feedback from all of you on a number of different topics from past episodes of the MacCast. So a lot of feedback to get into, and I have a thing of the moment for you. There's a bunch more stuff as well, but hang on, it's going to be a pretty good show. Before we get into that, though, I do want to take a second and say a huge, huge thank you to all of the new Patreon supporters who signed up this week. I really appreciate you stepping up and supporting the show. It means a lot to me. It goes a long way to help covering a lot of the costs we have here on the MacCast between hosting and equipment and all those sorts of things. And in the long run, it's going to help, I think, improve the show as well. I'll have the opportunity to do more things, hopefully get out to more places to meet you and hang out with the community in real life, something I've been wanting to do for a while. And your Patreon pledges and support are really going to help us get there and do that. I also wanted to mention I've received a number of suggestions. I mentioned on the last show that if you pledge at the $5 a month or higher level, you're going to get a MacCast membership card, and there's some benefits that go along with that. You can read about it over at patreon.com/MacCast, but I'm getting ready to kind of work on some of those designs and things like that. I'm going to be sharing them on the Patreon. And a few people emailed in and said, hey, if you do that, can we get a digital version of the membership card so we don't have to carry around a physical card? And I thought that was a great idea, something you can add to your iOS wallet. So I am going to look into that. As long as it's not too technically difficult, I don't think it is, and I can figure it out, we will definitely make that happen, especially for the MacCast, right? We need to have a digital membership card. And just so you know, a little update, we now have 168 supporters. We're about a third of the way to hitting our first pledge goal. So I think we can make it. I'd love to try and have 200 supporters by the next episode. So if you're inclined, check it out, patreon.com/MacCast. You can see the goals and the rewards and stuff there. You can get more information. And if you sign up to become a Patreon member, you also get access to our exclusive Patreon-only Slack channel. And there's a great community of you building up there. We're having some great conversations, helping people out with some of their technical issues. And you can, I'm on there every day. So if you have a question for me, you can shoot that to me, and I'm probably going to get back to you within a few minutes. And it is one of the benefits of becoming a Patreon supporter. So if you want to become a Patreon supporter, check it out, patreon.com/MacCast. And again, a big thank you to all of you who have already supported. And it's okay if you don't want to be a Patreon supporter as well. Continue to download and enjoy the show. And if you want to support the show in a couple other ways, one thing you can do is write us a review on iTunes, or just tell your friends about the show. If you have people who are into Macs and Apple and technology and you think they'll enjoy the show, pass it along. And if we can just get more people listening, that's a great way to contribute as well. So any of those things. But let's not delay anymore. You know, enough of the thank yous. Let's get right into this episode. So latest data from Consumer Intelligence Research Partners for iPhone sales between October and December of last year found that the iPhone 8 outsold both the iPhone 8 Plus and the iPhone 10. Not by a lot. 24% of buyers picked up an iPhone 8, while 20% of people buying phones between October and December bought iPhone 10s, and then 17% for the iPhone 8 Plus. What was interesting to me, actually, in these numbers was the fact that, at least for Apple buyers in that period, they didn't seem to be opting for the gigantophone. And everybody has always been saying that there's this trend toward larger phones, but people going for the smaller iPhone 8 and iPhone 10 size. And granted, the iPhone 10 has a large screen resolution, but it's still not as big as the iPhone 8 Plus. So I'm wondering if it could be just that techies, you know, early adopters, those of us who are really into technology, you know, the nerds and the geeks out there, we're the ones that want the bigger displays. And for kind of the rest of the folks, people who were probably buying over the holiday season, who didn't jump in, you know, back in early October, they're more inclined to get the smaller sized phones. It's an interesting thing to talk about, and it's going to come up a little bit later when we talk about some of Apple's plans for the future. And I'm curious to see how that plays in, and I'd love to get your opinions on that. So let me know by shooting me some feedback, mattcast@gmail.com. But, you know, there have been other surveys like this out there that have been showing that the iPhone X, at least, you know, as far as anyone can tell, because Apple doesn't share actual numbers or won't share actual numbers, it seems to be outselling, or the iPhone 8, rather, seems to be outselling the iPhone 10. And this has caused some mild panic for some investors, analysts, people in the media are starting to question if, you know, the iPhone is still can remain relevant and successful. And we had been hearing this, you know, going into the release of the iPhone 10. And I really think that none of this is a surprise to Apple. You know, I think they knew that they were going to come out with a three iPhone lineup with the iPhone 8, the 8 Plus, and the 10. And they were really positioning the 10 as kind of this new thing. And I figure they thought, maybe we'll sell about a third in each category. And it does seem to be panning out that way. In case you're wondering what the other percentage is, that large percentage is sort of missing in those numbers, because we have, you know, what, 24%, 20%, and 17%. That other, I think it amounts to about 34%. I'm probably doing my math wrong. Anyway, that's just all the other models of iPhone that Apple sells. So the iPhone SE, older iPhone 6s and 6 Pluses, and all the other ones that you can pick up. So, you know, I really don't think Apple is too worried about this stuff. I believe it was all strategically planned. I think Apple knows its audience very, very well. I think they know that the iPhone 10 is going to mostly us nerds and big hardcore geeks out there, and it was at a higher price point. They had to expect that, you know, pushing the phone price over $1,000 was going to turn off some customers, and I think that's also why they did the kinds of updates they did to the iPhone 8 and 8 Plus with the wireless charging and a lot of the same features that you're getting in the 10. Obviously, you don't get things like the OLED display and the 3D true depth camera sensors and all that stuff, but the whole lineup is a compelling set of offerings, and I think they kind of hit each type of buyer, and I think that's what we're seeing is sort of this evening out. Now, Canalysis estimates that Apple shipped about 29 million iPhone 10 units in the fourth quarter last year. That's actually Apple's first quarter of 2018, and they also said that about 7 million, almost 25% of those, were sent to China. And I thought, well, actually, they were really already there, but they got distributed out in China. You kind of get my point, right? And they noted that those numbers were still below their expectations. And in their report, they also said, you know, many buyers are opting for the iPhone 8s or a lot of Apple's older models. So, you know, is this a problem or not? Well, our favorite analyst, Ming-Chi Kuo, wrote a note to his investors, and he says, despite the iPhone 10 numbers, really, the iPhone 10 is a strategic success. And what does he mean by that? He pointed to the Face ID technology and the true depth camera system, and he reiterated something he had said before, which was his belief that that technology has really put Apple 2 years ahead of the competition. He fully expects, and I fully expect as well, that we're going to see Apple's competitors trying to implement similar features into their products, but their technology, they just haven't put the work in. Apple has been working for years on Face ID and True Depth, and they really have a technological leap head start, and it's going to take a while for their competitors to catch up. And meanwhile, these technologies are going to be the main drivers for other Apple technologies to push other Apple innovations further, innovations in advanced augmented reality and artificial intelligence applications and things like that. So Apple's going to keep iterating from where they're at, and it's going to be hard for others to catch up. He also pointed out that, you know, by bringing out this premium phone, pushing the price tag above $1,000, Apple has really opened up its options to expand features for future premium offerings. They kind of broke through that price ceiling. And, you know, different people have different feelings about that, that, you know, driving up the costs for smartphones, high-end smartphones, is not necessarily a great thing for the consumer. It certainly is a great thing for Apple's bottom line. And when you think about it, if you're trying to implement advanced technologies, that's a lot of money that goes into that, and those components cost more. So you're going to have to pay a little bit more to get those premium features, and that's also why I think Apple's expanding out its lineup to more models and trying to hit more price points. And as a matter of fact, Min-Chi Kuo also provided a few more details on his thoughts about the next generation of iPhones, specifically that rumored 6.1-inch mid-entry-level model that he's been talking about. We've talked about it a little bit here on the show. He had already mentioned that he expects that model to have a true-depth camera system and the Face ID technology, Apple implementing that across the board in this year's lineup. But he also mentions that, and it had also mentioned, rather, that it would use a traditional LCD screen, all of these things to try and keep the price down. But now he says that it will have an aluminum frame, though he didn't really mention if that meant it's still going to have an aluminum back or if it's, you know, going to have a glass back. So we don't know if it'll have wireless charging or not. I have a feeling that moving forward, at least for all of the top end, you know, this year's release of iPhone models, Apple's going to want to have wireless charging across the board. I think that's a new standard feature. So I don't expect that to go away. So I'm thinking this is going to be a design very similar to the current iPhone 8 and 8 Plus design. And he claims there will be a single lens on the rear-facing camera. And most interestingly, in my opinion, no 3D touch. And the lack of 3D touch just seems like that would be a big step backward, really potentially limiting the device, since so much of iOS currently can take advantage of 3D touch. Now, I know Apple's implemented a lot of the features in a way where you don't need 3D touch, so maybe that's the thought process there, and they can save some money by not integrating that technology. But if that's not in there, in my opinion, it almost feels like Apple's conceding that technology is really not that critical in the operation of iOS. And then you have to wonder, well, will they just make it go away entirely? Was it kind of a failed experiment? I know for me, I often forget about 3D touch. When I remember it's there and use it, I like a lot of the features and functionality. But because it's so hidden, I think a lot of consumers and a lot of people just don't kind of, it's not something that you latch on to. And it's interesting because we were that way, I think, in the early days with technologies like just multi-touch gestures. And we kind of learned that language. But 3D touch has been a little bit of a harder learning curve, at least for me. I don't know. Maybe I'm in the minority. Maybe other people use it consistently on a day-to-day basis and have no problem with it. I'd love to hear from you if 3D touch has really revolutionized the way you use your iPhone. But for me, it really hasn't changed a whole lot. I do occasionally find sometimes on my iPad, I try to implement, you know, activate 3D touch features and then realize, oh, I don't have it here. I have to do the long press instead of the 3D touch. So who knows? But, you know, internally, that new iPhone, the new 6.1 inch, is said to look more like a standard iPhone, standard meaning the iPhone 8 and 8 Plus. So it's not going to have the iPhone 10's unique stacked logic board. And Min-Chi Kuo says the battery is going to be a standard, you know, rectangular shaped battery versus the L-shaped one that you have in the iPhone X. So expect the 6.1-inch model to look more like an iPhone 8 or 8 Plus. And as far as price goes, he says it's going to be between $700 and $800, which is about $50 more expensive than the last time he talked about this model. He expects it to sell really well. He thinks because of the price point, it will probably make up about 50% of the 80 to 90 million iPhones he expects Apple to ship in the second half of 2018. And it's expected this will be announced as usual in the fall along the full lineup of iPhones. So on a 5.8-inch iPhone X, and many people will be excited about this. It's expected we're going to get a larger iPhone X and iPhone X Plus. And I don't know if the models are going to be called iPhone Xs this year, if Apple will hold on to that name or go to 11. Yeah, a little. They could have a lot of fun with that if they are going to do that. So is it going to be an iPhone 11, or will they keep the iPhone 10 moniker sort of like they have or did with Mac OS for a long time? I don't really know. I'm kind of on the fence about that. DigiTimes, though, seems to disagree with Ming-Chi Kuo. Their analysts are saying that Apple will stick with two LCD models on in the lineup and one OLED model. So kind of sticking with what they have, you know, what they released in 2017. But the difference they're saying is that Apple will ship a 5.7, 5.8-inch LCD model and a 6 to 6.1-inch LCD model, and then on the top end replace the current 5.8-inch iPhone X OLED model with a massive 6.4 to 6.5-inch screen. So if you want to stick with the top-of-the-line iPhone, you're going to have to go with a bigger iPhone. You know, if you've been listening to the MacCast, I am not a fan of the large-size phones, and I think that would stink. I really am not buying the DigiTimes report on this. I think Ming-Chi Kuo has the right sort of idea that they'll do this little bit larger LCD version and then keep the 5.8-inch and then do a gigantophone, you know, like a 6.5-inch iPhone X for those people who want that model. Because I know a lot of you who wrote in had an iPhone 7 Plus and did not want to go get a 10 because you really like the larger phone size. And there are a lot of people out there that really like those very large phones. And I think Apple wants to cater to that crowd. So I don't know. It's interesting. The other thing DigiTimes says is that there is going to be a new iPhone SE. They say it's in the works. And I know we've already kind of had rumblings of this, but they say that they expect it to have a glass back and wireless charging support, although not a true depth camera system, again, because of the price point. I find it surprising that it might even have wireless charging at that price point. But I'm thinking that is kind of a base feature that Apple wants to implement across the board, especially since they have their new AirPad wireless charging pad coming out, so you can do multiple devices. It'll help kind of drive sales of that. So I'm thinking wireless charging across the board in 2018. I think that's not too big of a stretch. And they do expect, of course, a spec bump. I think we've talked about this a little bit, an A10 Fusion chip, 2 gigs of RAM, and coming in 32 gigabyte and 128 gigabyte storage capacities. So that would be a nice little bump up for the iPhone SE, and that continues to be a hugely popular model. There's some debate on whether or not they will bump the size up, but I think they stick with the 4-inch size in that model because, again, I think that's one of the key selling points for it, is a lot of people like smaller phones. So you got people on one end that like the huge phones, and you also have a ton of people on the other end that like the small form factor, and the iPhone SE is just due for an update. As far as when that will happen, they believe it'll be launched in May or June, although previous rumors had kind of mentioned a first quarter launch, so you would think a little bit earlier than that. I don't know why we're getting kind of a more delayed number now from DigiTimes, or release date from DigiTimes, but you know, maybe they needed some more time to kind of tweak things in terms of the design. But anyway, either maybe the end of the first quarter or sometime in the second quarter, we might expect an iPhone SE update. And that is kind of the latest of what's going on with iPhones. Another computer, or couple of computers, that have gone a pretty long time without seeing an update are the MacBook Air and the MacBook. And something interesting happened this week, also coming from DigiTimes, a report with a sparse amount of info indicating that Apple is planning on adding a new entry-level 13-inch MacBook to its lineup in the second half of this year. The report is based on Apple supposedly placing an order for LCDs with general interface solutions. So this is coming out of the supply chain. Tim Cook always says never trust the supply chain, but it's interesting to think about. Now, you know, just the fact that Apple's placing an order for 13-inch LCDs, it's kind of a bit of a leap to say, well, this is a whole brand new MacBook that they're working on. So it's pretty speculative. But when you step back and kind of think about it, I don't think it's totally out of the realm of possibility. You know, Apple hasn't done much with the MacBook, and they've done even less with the MacBook Air. We've been talking about, I'm actually frankly surprised that MacBook Air is still in the lineup, but it's a nice entry-level model. It's Apple's only notebook, I think, priced at a sub, just barely, $999, sub $1,000 price point. But, you know, it's due for a shakeup, I guess is what I would say. And it's not even clear if the displays, these new displays that Apple ordered, were Retina or not. And you might note that the entry-level MacBook Air right now is Apple's last non-Retina laptop. So I think it's high time that maybe we move the entire lineup to Retina, including the base model. And if you think about how would you do that if you were Apple, I think it makes a lot of sense for the MacBook Air to be retired. The MacBooks are just as light and thin as the MacBook Air at this point. So replacing it with a MacBook, a 13-inch MacBook at a $999 price point, I think that's totally the logical thing to do. The question then becomes, what are the specs going to be? What is it going to look like? Is it going to, you know, have the single USB port of the MacBook? I think yes. And I think it just slots right into the lineup right at the bottom. And then you do a spec bump across the board to the other models. And the MacBook Air, awesome machine that it's been, goes off into the sunset. And that's the way it goes. Now, I know a lot of you out there probably aren't going to like that because there's a whole lot of love for the MacBook Air. But, you know, I think Apple is generally not nostalgic about their machines, and when it's time to move on, they kind of move on. So this may be the first hints of that, or it could be something completely different. We really don't know. Again, it's all speculation at this point. So HomePod pre-orders started this week for the US, UK, and Australia. They actually happened on Friday. I don't know if you ordered one, but I got my order in, and if you want to order one right now, I think you can still get one for the arrival date of February 9th, which is when they're shipping. And you can have it shipped to the store. You can have it shipped directly to you. And I have a feeling there are going to be a lot available in store on launch day two. So I wouldn't be surprised if you can walk into an Apple store on February 9th and pick up a HomePod, mainly because of what we talked about on the last episode, where there was a rumor that they had already produced, at least with one of their suppliers, about a million HomePods, and each supplier has about 50% of the orders, so you would presume about 2 million are ready to go, and I expect Apple will probably sell about 4 million in the first year, 5 million, maybe more. If they can do more, that's great, but it's kind of one of those products that I think appeals to only a certain subset of the Apple community and techies in general, and we're going to talk about some of the reasons for that here in a second. But because the HomePod is now getting ready to ship, we have a lot more details. Some people have gotten their hands on them. So I wanted to share some of the news and information that's coming out related to the HomePod. One thing is that, at least at launch, it is only going to be able to use and understand English, the three versions of English, U.S. English, U.K. U.K. English, and Australian English. Those will be your options when you set up your HomePod, and that's likely because those are the three launch countries. The HomePod will be coming to France and Germany this spring. We don't have a date, but that seems to be the next place where HomePod will hit, and I fully expect them to adjust the software languages by then. We also have found out that the HomePod is going to be able to support the FLAC lossless audio format. You'll need to actually send that audio to the HomePod using an app that obviously can play FLAC, and you do it through AirPlay. And it will likely also need AirPlay 2 support, which is not going to be there on day one. So you may not be able to play your FLAC audio files right from day one. But this, the fact that FLAC support is in there has caused a lot of people to kind of speculate that Apple's getting ready to start doing Apple Music in a lossless format. I wouldn't jump that far in the conclusion. I think this is purely a sort of technical thing with the HomePod because it has the power and it has the A8 chipsets and stuff in there. I think it just has those capabilities. But I don't expect Apple to be starting to push out lossless audio through Apple Music anytime soon, although I know a lot of audiophiles are hoping that will happen. The HomePod will also be able to be set up like a lot of Apple's devices are now, the Apple TV, with just simply tapping your iPhone to the HomePod. So quick and easy setup. And doing that will link it up with your iCloud account and iCloud features. And that means that each HomePod will be tied to a single user, at least for some of the main iCloud syncing features. There's no multi-user support, at least not at launch. I'm still hoping that's something that will come in the future, but it means things, voice commands for things like sending texts and sending, setting up reminders and getting calendar notifications and voice notifications on the HomePod will be the texts and reminders and notifications for the person who set up the HomePod. And they're doing something really interesting with the security and privacy related to that, because obviously if you're not at home, you probably don't want other people in your household to maybe check up on your texts or add funky reminders to your calendar or something like that. So when your iPhone or your iOS devices are not on the Wi-Fi network with the HomePod, those features are then disabled or unable to be used by other people in your household. Although everybody can use general features, of course, like music playback, getting news and weather, podcasts, you know, general Siri stuff, stuff that's not tied specifically to your iCloud account, all of that stuff will continue to work. So it's kind of multi-user in that regard, but in terms of all of your iCloud syncing with calendars and contacts, that's really linked to a single person in the household. And again, I hope that's something that Apple changes, because, you know, the HomePod is meant to go in your living room. Most people, I shouldn't say most people, but there are a lot of people out there that, you know, have more than one person in their household. And you're going to want to be able to use the HomePod and use the cool Siri features for like managing your calendar and notifications and stuff like that. So hopefully that does change in the near future. Something interesting about HomePod and its energy consumption, it will actually consume less power than an average LED light bulb when playing music at 50% volume. So while you're using it, it's consuming less power than an LED light bulb, about 8.74 watts versus about 9 to 10 for a typical LED bulb. So it's very energy efficient. And when it goes into low power mode, which happens after about 8 minutes of non-use, it only draws between 1.71 and 1.76 watts. So you can leave it in listening for your Siri commands and not have to worry about totally destroying the environment. Obviously, it's using a little bit of power, but hey, that's not too bad. Unfortunately, there are going to be a number of kind of key features that are not going to be available at launch. Multi-room audio playback and AirPlay 2 support and the ability to do stereo pairing. Those are coming, Apple says, at a future date. It's looking like that might come with the iOS 11.3 update. And when we go talk about that in a little bit, you'll understand why that is. It will support peer-to-peer AirPlay, though, your standard AirPlay at launch, so you still can use it as an AirPlay speaker. HomePod will also function as a HomeKit hub, so if you don't have an Apple TV 4th generation or better, or you don't want to leave an iPad or something set up for your HomeKit, you know, when you're away from the house, then your HomePod can serve as that hub. And despite the fact that the HomePod has Bluetooth built into it, Unfortunately, it cannot, at least again at launch, function as a Bluetooth speaker. It uses Wi-Fi and AirPlay exclusively, and I know that's going to kind of put off and upset a few people, but that's kind of some of the things that aren't there right at launch. And a lot of these things seem like they're either software updates or tweaks or things that could be enabled at a future date. We really don't know at this point what Apple's total plans for the HomePod are. So we're just going to have to keep an eye on what Apple's up to and see what new features roll out as software updates come out. You can get AppleCare Plus for your new HomePod. It's going to cost you $39 US on your $349 investment, and that coverage includes airport products and adds up to 2 incidents of accidental damage from handling your HomePod to your coverage. Those accidental damage incidents, though, are subject to a $39 service fee. And I'm trying to think, you know, what could happen to your HomePod once you've kind of set it up and put it in your room to where it might suffer accidental damage? Not really sure. I guess maybe if you're in an earthquake zone and it falls off the shelf or something like that, or somebody just bumps into it and knocks it on the floor, I guess. I'm going to hopefully secure mine and put it in a pretty secure place. So I did not opt in for the $39 AppleCare Plus for my HomePod. We'll see. Oh, and I didn't mention, the biggest dilemma I had when I was ordering my HomePod was which color to get, white or space gray. I ended up going with white, which is something that I don't normally do. I almost always opt for the space gray, but something about the white just made me think, yeah, that's going to be cool. Although a few people have already pointed out concerns over dust and just other people touching it with maybe dirty fingers, and maybe that white covering getting a little bit grungy over time. We'll have to see how that holds up, but we'll report on that, you know, maybe toward the end of the year. I'll let you know how my HomePod is shaping up with dirt and dust. A little bit of information on how you physically control your new HomePod. Of course, I think most people are going to use the Siri voice controls, but if you do want to control it physically, it does have that really cool touch display on top. So you can tap to play pause, double tap to get next track, triple tap to get your previous track, touch and hold for Siri activation, and you can disable Siri's voice options and just go with touching the touch panel. And that's pretty easy to do. You just tell Siri, basically, stop listening, and she won't. And then you can reactivate her later from, I think I had read that it gets activated through the Home app in HomeKit, but don't quote me on that. A few other things, it does have volume controls on there, so there's a little plus symbol for turning the volume up and a minus symbol for turning the volume down. And there may be some other touch gestures that we just haven't heard about yet, because it is a cool touchscreen display. And supposedly the Siri animation that displays on it is really neat as well. And we know about this because Apple set up some demos in New York and London for select members of the media. They got a little hands-on time with the HomePod, and overall, the reviews are generally pretty positive, I have to say. A lot of people were really enamored and just impressed by the HomePod. Now, they did set it up with playing a pre-selected group of tracks, and it was in an Apple-controlled environment, so I want to be clear about that. You know, I don't think these were totally unbiased conditions, right? And we're going to have to wait until these sites, and myself included, we all get it in our hands and we're able to actually listen and give our opinions in our own homes and environments. But right off the bat, at least for how Apple had set it up, most of the folks in the media were pretty impressed. They had a HomePod set up. They also had a Sonos One, a Google Home Max, and an Amazon Echo, and they played the same tracks on all of those units. And almost every reviewer praised the sound quality, the Apple HomePod. They say it beat out all of those speakers. Probably the second closest to the HomePod in most of the reviews that I read was the Sonos One. And the Amazon Echo didn't fare well at all in comparison to the other three. But I think that's not a fair comparison, because the Amazon Echo is at a much lower price point. It's not even really in the same class as the other three. And the Amazon Echo is a great product. I know a ton of people who really love their Amazon Echo, and they think the sound quality is perfectly fine for most of the things they do on a day-to-day basis, and you know, you save a ton of money. But as far as the HomePod audio, you know, it's really not surprising. Apple really focused on that. It has a 7-tweeter array. It has a woofer that has a diaphragm that can move up and down 20 millimeters, so it can really push a lot of air, push out a lot of bass. It's powered by a super powerful A8 chip. And many of the reviewers said when they were listening to it, it just had really crisp highs. Everything was clean and clear. There was great separation. You could really make out individual parts of the music. Some likened it to being at a live concert. There was just kind of a tone or a sense to the audio that just made you think this is really clear and clean and crisp and just great. And so it just has really great spatial separation, even just from one speaker, because of the technology that Apple has built into that thing. Now, one reviewer did note that he felt the HomePod came up a little bit short in the mid-range. So the fact that it, you know, does have tweeters and just the woofers, it seemed to fall a little flat in the mid-tones, at least in his opinion. But that was only one reviewer out of probably, I think Apple showed it off to about a dozen or so reporters. I read a lot about the HomePod, and the sound, they all said, was great from wherever you would move in the room. And of course, that's thanks to the spatial awareness that's built into the HomePod. You set it down and it tunes the speakers for the environment. You can also pick up the HomePod, apparently, and it has an accelerometer in it, rather, that will detect and recalibrate itself when you put it down. So if you move it around the room, it will sense that you're doing that and retune itself. You don't have to do anything extra. I thought that was just kind of a cool feature, although, like I said earlier, most of us, I think, are going to set it up once and you're never going to move it again. They also all noted how good Siri was at detecting your voice, even when it was playing music at a moderately high volume, 80%, and you didn't even have to shout over the audio. Siri would pick up. I think that's largely helped by the 6-microphone array that is in the HomePod. And many also pointed out the fact that Apple had seriously upped Siri's knowledge of music. You can ask her all kinds of music related questions, including things like, you know, who's the drummer on this track and stuff like that, and it goes in pretty deep on her depth of knowledge. You can have her DJ for you, find your favorite music, all of that stuff. And it supposedly works really great, which is a great thing to hear, especially for me, because I've been having a lot of problems with Siri on the iPhone, as you know, especially when there's a lot of background noise or music playing, stuff that I didn't have issues with in the past. So hopefully they'll take some of that fine-tuning of the software layer of Siri as it relates to playing music and activating on the HomePod and work that back into iOS 11. I think they have some fine-tuning and tweaking to do there. You know, at the end of it, it was all very positive, but I think rightly so, many questioned if having the best sounding smart speaker would really be enough for Apple to make a difference in this space, especially at the higher price point. As a matter of fact, the day before the HomePod went on sale, Sonos began offering 2 of their Sonos Ones for the same price. $349 will get you 2 Sonos Ones at this point, the price of 1 Apple HomePod. And that is a tempting offer, especially considering the fact that the Sonos One audio quality is about the closest to the HomePod. And, you know, I think 2 things about a lot of the kind of, I don't want to say negative, but a lot of the people who are trying to compare the HomePod to some of the other smart speakers that are on the market, there's 2 things for me that come to mind. One, that reviewers are missing the point of the HomePod. And 2, likely Apple is not concerned about this and they really don't care. I think from Apple's perspective, they set out to make an incredibly awesome sounding home speaker that integrates with the Apple ecosystem. And that's really exactly what they seem to have achieved with this. And in reading the reviews, I think Apple absolutely spot on, hit their goal. And once again, many in the tech media, they want to rate Apple's performance in a race that they haven't even entered. Like, Apple is not in the smart speaker race. They are in their own little world, doing their own little thing. And so I think a more valid question might be, is Apple making a mistake by not getting into that race? You know, should they be in that race, or are they going to get left behind? And there are some people asking that, and I think that's a valid question. I definitely agree that I think Siri needs to get more functional. She needs to be able to do more things. She needs to be more intelligent about a lot of stuff. And it does feel like Siri's falling behind a little bit. But if we're just stepping back and taking Siri out of the equation and looking at the product that Apple has built here, I still think they have achieved success, at least from their perspective. Maybe not from the perspective of analysts and those in the tech media, and that's kind of what we're seeing being played out. But it also doesn't mean that there aren't some critical points about the HomePod that aren't valid. There's definitely some valid criticisms. One of the big ones is that it only supports Apple Music at launch for the Siri features. You can play iTunes purchase music, you can do Beats 1, you can do podcasts without Apple Music, but if you use a third-party music app, like if you're a Spotify fan, you're not an Apple Music fan, your only option is going to be able to play Spotify through your iOS device using AirPlay. There is no Spotify app. Spotify can't put an app on the HomePod, at least at this point. And, you know, that's a valid complaint, because I don't think everybody wants to use Apple Music, nor do I think maybe Apple should force everyone to try and use Apple Music. But once again, there are other great options for you if you're a Spotify fan. You can get a Sonos, and it will integrate great into your environment. And I think that's sort of the position Apple's taking. If you are all in on the Apple ecosystem, like myself, I love Apple Music. It's my audio service of choice, and the HomePod is going to fit great into my environment. I am a HomeKit guy. You know, I'm all in on Apple, and I think really that's what this product is targeted at. Now, I do want to point out, despite early reports to the contrary, it's looking like it will support playback of your iCloud music library. So if you are an iTunes Match user, you can rejoice. A lot of the early reports said that it was not going to support iCloud Music Library or iTunes Match, that it was only Apple Music. Serenity Caldwell over at iMore got news just today back from Apple that it will support iCloud Music Library. It is not clear, however, if Siri will be able to work her music knowledge magic on your uploaded non-matched tracks. But anything that's matched or in iTunes, it should work perfectly fine with. And, you know, I think Apple will eventually add some third-party app support, as they often do. Maybe we'll even get an announcement at Worldwide Developer Conference. And, you know, I think apps will be on the way, and I think they'll integrate third-party support. But at launch, you know, this is an Apple product. It's all about the Apple ecosystem, and it's all about Apple doing what Apple does, which is making great consumer products that are easy to set up, easy to use, and integrate right into all of the stuff that you already have. And I'm really pretty excited now about getting my HomePod in February. And of course, I'll let you know my exact opinions when I actually get hands-on myself with it and come play around with it. And I definitely want to hear your thoughts and opinions. Did you order a HomePod? Are you excited about it? If you didn't, why not? And what are you not excited about? And once you receive your HomePod, send me an audio comment, a quick review. Let me know your first thoughts and impressions and whether you're liking it or not. So you can send those to maccast@gmail.com. Okay, let's get into some of the OS updates and betas that have been released recently. iOS 11.2.5 came out. They added support for the upcoming HomePod release. They also fixed that nasty Chai OS messaging bug. And they made a couple of UI changes for audio sources in Control Center. This one is probably the most interesting little update in there. I don't know if you've opened up the audio playback control tile in Control Center. But if you bring up the expanded audio tile, either by tapping on the little signal icon in the upper right-hand corner or using 3D Touch or a long press, you know, to get in where you see the full controls, what will happen is you'll see after a moment if you have any other audio sources on your network, or if you have Bluetooth audio sources around, they'll show up in little tiles underneath that main panel, and you can tap on them to use that as an audio source. So it makes it a little easier to discover what audio sources are available. Interestingly enough, though, it still has the little icon in the upper right-hand corner that does the same exact thing. And this is a complaint I've had about Apple's UI in recent years, where Apple has started to make multiple ways to do exactly the same action. And I think that's really confusing from a user interface standpoint. Like, let me learn one way to do something and don't give me like several dozen ways. Okay, several dozen is a little bit of an exaggeration, but you get my point. Don't give me like three ways to do the same thing because it just ends up being really confusing. Or it really bothers me when they put the same settings in two different settings areas. It's like suddenly you're down deep down in one settings area and you see a control that's off in another settings panel and you're like, why is this here? Is it the same thing? Is it something different? I really don't know. So I really don't like it when Apple does that. Hopefully this was just an oversight and they'll kind of change that functionality. But some interesting updates in iOS 11.2.5. If you haven't grabbed it yet, it should be available in your software update. And then right after that, Apple released a new beta to both developers and public beta testers. iOS 11.3 beta is out, and it has a bunch of really interesting new and neat features. It's offering a new health records section inside the health app, and this is going to allow you to connect and download your health records through participating healthcare provider patient portals. Right now, they just have a handful of providers in there at the moment, so it's beta. Unfortunately, my healthcare provider isn't in there, so I won't be able to test it out and use it and let you know how it works. But basically, it'll pull down that data. All the data is encrypted and protected with your passcode, so it's kept safe. And I think it'd be really neat to have your medical records there kind of at the touch of a button right there on your device. Something that I really don't keep track of too much. I don't even know. I think my provider has a patient portal, but I've probably never logged into it. But if I had it right there on my phone, I think I might be more apt to use it. Another cool thing in the iOS 11.3 beta is the next version of ARKit, ARKit 1.5, and they've added the ability to map and recognize vertical surfaces. So now you can not only place things onto a wall, but you could also put them up or onto a table surface, but you could also put them up onto a wall as well. And they added better detection for irregularly shaped surfaces like circle tables. And I noticed in my own ARKit usage that that can sometimes be a problem. So some other things with ARKit 1.5, it can find and recognize the position of 2D images in signs and posters and artwork and actually bring them out into augmented reality experiences. And they've increased the resolution of viewing the real world through your device's camera. So 50% better resolution, which is going to make the whole experience, I think, feel a lot more real when you've placed something into that environment and you're looking through the lens of your iPhone. They added a bunch of new Animoji. So if you're an Animoji fan, you now get lion, dragon, skull, and bear. I love the new ones. The dragon one is amazing. When that comes out, you're going to really enjoy playing with that, I think. And they're adding business chat to messages. This is something that I think could be pretty cool. It's going to allow you to have conversations with a service representative or schedule an appointment or make purchases using Apple Pay with participating vendors and retailers. So it's going to launch this spring with select support from businesses, including companies like Discover, Hilton, Lowe's, and Wells Fargo. And what's cool about the business chat is it doesn't share any of your contact information at all. And you can, you know, stop chatting at any time with any one of the businesses. So it's going to be a really good way, I think, to get chat support on your iOS device. I've never really liked having to go through some of the web interfaces. They've always felt a little bit clunky. They work, but you kind of really don't know what's going on. And it'd be nice to just have a built-in messages experience when you're trying to get customer support through chat. So I think that's a really cool new feature, and I think it's something that could be very, very useful. 11.3 is also going to bring the new battery notification improvements that Apple has promised. It's going to give users the ability to disable the power management feature on their phone if they have an aged battery. So if you don't like what Apple's doing, Apple's going to let you toggle it off now. It's also going to be more clear about the fact that your battery is in a less than ideal state, and really recommend that you get a battery replacement. This feature is not in the beta release yet, so if you go looking for it in there, you're not going to find it, but it is coming and will be there whenever Apple releases iOS 11.3. There's also a new privacy icon in here, and this is an interesting feature. This is going to pop up anytime an app or a feature is asking to use your personal information, and it's being controlled at a system level. So it's looking like Apple is adding the privacy icon because of some of the fake dialogues and sort of hacking and spoofing that people try to do on iOS to get your personal information. So what will happen now is if you see a dialogue pop up asking for personal information like a password, you should see this little privacy icon if it's an official one from Apple or from an official app. If it's not, it's kind of your indication, beware, this could be a spoofed dialogue. So that should help all of us keep our personal information safer, and that's always a good thing. And while AirPlay 2 is not going to be in the HomePod at launch, it does look like it's built into iOS 11.3 and tvOS 11.3. So that means that AirPlay 2 is coming, and probably when iOS 11.3 launches, I'm assuming that's when the HomePod will get its AirPlay 2 update as well. But for those people who are beta testing, that means if you have a couple of fourth generation or later Apple TVs, you can use AirPlay to send audio to both of those Apple TVs at the same time. And another interesting thing about AirPlay 2 support is it looks like you can now add your Apple TV to your HomeKit setup. And it doesn't do a lot right now, but it will show up in HomeKit, and you can tap on its controls inside HomeKit to play and pause the music that is playing on your Apple TV. So a little update there as well. And then finally, one of the last things to talk about with iOS 11.3 is something that came from Mark Gurman over at 9to5Mac. He noticed that the iBooks app has simply been renamed Books, and he says that Apple is planning an iTunes store-like redesign to the Now Books app to give it an even simpler interface, and that they'll be adding a Now Reading section, which I assume is kind of like the Now Playing section in the TV app. And so it looks like Apple is starting to redouble down on its book efforts. As a matter of fact, last month, Apple also hired Kashif Zafar as global head of iBooks, and he was the former senior vice president of Amazon's Audible business. So Apple adding some new folks to the books team and making some changes to the books app, and that'll be great for those of you who are iBooks fans. Moving on to tvOS 11.3, we talked about the AirPlay 2 thing, but there's also some other enhancements. Apple made enhancements to the Match content support. They added automatic frame rate switching for the fourth generation Apple TV. That was something that was added, as you might remember, to the Apple TV 4K, along with the auto switching of HDR modes. And so that's great if you have content that might be in, say, a 24 frames per second versus 29-30 frames per second. You'll now be able to, with your fourth generation Apple TV, set that so that auto switches based on the content that's coming in. Of course, the fourth gen Apple TV can't do the HDR switching because it doesn't have HDR support. You need a 4K Apple TV for that. But at least half of that feature is making its way to the older model, that's good to see. And finally, automatic mode switching for AirPlay video sessions. The macOS 10.13.4 beta was also released this past week, and I think there's one really interesting thing to note in here. Some folks were digging around and looking at some of the privacy information that is in that update, and what they discovered is there's some hints, some text that seem to indicate that there may be a standalone podcast app. This is something that a lot of us have been thinking Apple needed to bring to the Mac for a few years now. You know, they separated it on iOS a long time ago. Question became, why have they not separated it, pulled it out of iTunes on the Mac? Well, it does look like that might be happening. It could arrive soon, maybe as soon as with the macOS 10.13.4 update. No guarantees, but I would love to see that happen, a standalone podcast app. Hopefully it's implemented a little bit better than the iOS one, and the two will kind of play off of each other, and we'll get improvements across the board. I'm not that down on the podcast app. It's actually what I use on my devices, and I'm pretty okay with it, but I know there's a number of you out there who get a little frustrated with it. So it'll be interesting to see what Apple does with that, especially on the Mac side, if it does end up being a standalone application. And then a few other things to talk about. Swift Playgrounds 2.0 came out. Some pretty interesting changes there. They added a new ability to subscribe to Playgrounds from third-party creators. I went in and looked at this. A lot of it is the hardware integrations. So you may or may not know, you can do Swift Playgrounds with things like Spheros and Parrot drones and a bunch of other robots and stuff like that. All of that stuff has been sort of pulled out and put into this new subscription thing. So you can subscribe to, say, the Sphero Playgrounds, and anytime Sphero puts out new content related to Swift Playgrounds, you'll just get automatically updated on that. So it feels a little bit in my mind like iTunes U subscriptions and stuff like that, almost like a podcast subscription, but for learning code, which is interesting. They also added support for a couple of new robots, including IBM's JBot and the new Mechamon spider drones that they're selling in the Apple retail stores. I don't know if you've seen those. If you've been into an Apple retail store recently, they have these kind of spider-looking drones, and they can have battles and fight each other. They look really, really cool, and you'll be able to play with those in Swift Playgrounds as well with the new 2.0 update. And then finally, one last thing to note in the iOS betas that was discovered, there seems to be some hints indicating that a quote-unquote modern iPad is coming. And what does that mean? It looks like it's going to be an iPad with Face ID support. So I don't know that this is huge news. Apple is going to be updating the iPads sometime in 2018, and it's looking like they'll probably get Face ID and the True Depth sensor system and stuff like that. And I think that's the natural progression for the iPads, especially on the upper end of the iPads. So hints in there in iOS, making it look like that is something that probably will be happening pretty soon. But with that, that is going to do it for all of those updates. That's all we get to talk about there. And then I almost made it a week without talking about a new original content show from Apple. But nope, there is yet another series rumored to be picked up by Apple's team. This time around, it's a drama series from La La Land creator Damien Chazelle. And this is according to Variety and the New York Times. We don't know much about this, but supposedly Chazelle will write and direct each episode himself. He's also going to be an executive producer along with a couple other folks. The series is going to be produced by Media Rights Capital. We don't know what the series is or what it's going to be about. Now, he did recently sign a deal also with Netflix to produce a musical series. So considering he's doing that in La La Land, you would have thought, oh, he's going to do some sort of musical thing over for Apple as well. But the idea of a musical drama, I don't know. Maybe that works. Maybe it doesn't. I don't think that's what it's going to be. I think this is going to be a straight up drama. We just don't know what the subject matter is or anything at this point. But supposedly Apple has signed yet another show for its original content team. And I told you last time, I'm getting pretty excited about a lot of the shows that Apple's putting together. I think they're going to be some great content, and I'm looking forward to being able to check that out. And who knows when it's going to happen. I'm guessing we're going to get a big sort of media announcement in the fall, like we used to with the release of new iPods. So I think that's going to be, I think Apple will probably do it as its own special event, not in conjunction maybe with the iPhone announcements. I think we'll have maybe something in September, and then October we'll get back to that, and who knows, that could be really fun and interesting. So if that does happen, I look forward to that going on this year. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. I want to talk to you about PDF Pen, and mainly because we're getting here. It's, the year just ended, and we're moving into that time of year that we all kind of dread. I think we all kind of dread tax season. And PDF Pen is great for getting your stuff together, organizing your documents for the end of the year. And end of the year is one of the times when I really most rely on PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro, because running the MacCast and doing my web development company means that I get an influx of tax documents and forms at this time that I need to deal with. And PDF Pen Pro really lets me handle that stuff with ease. I can merge and combine documents. I can split documents up, stuff that I need to send off. Sometimes in those documents, I need to redact or remove sensitive information like account numbers that don't need to be sent to certain people. They need other data and information that might be in a document. And PDF Pen Pro doesn't just cover up that data. It also makes sure that it goes into the text and the OCR and metadata and removes that, so someone can't get in there and steal my information. And I really appreciate that. It also really makes filling out forms easy, especially a lot of what I call the fake forms. These are things that look like forms, but it's just something really somebody scanned in, and it doesn't have any fill-in fields. So you can add all your fill-in fields to that. You can do it on the computer. You don't have to do this convoluted thing of like printing it out, filling it out with pen and paper, and scanning it back in. That's not paperless, right? We want to stay paperless. So PDF Pen allows you to do that. You can also sign, and most importantly to me when I'm emailing documents around, encrypt and secure my PDFs before I'm sending them off. That way I can protect it with a password and then just call up the person I sent it to and give that to them over the phone. Keeps it completely separate and secure. And PDF Pen really is the ultimate tool for editing PDFs and going paperless. And if you step up to PDF Pen Pro, you get even more advanced features like the ability to create PDF portfolios, collections of multiple PDFs and related files. And again, that's great for culling together and organizing and presenting your end of year documents. So you can learn more about PDF Pen at smilesoftware.com/podcast. You can get your copy of PDF Pen or PDF Pen Pro. It is going to be a vital tool for you this time of year. So jump in and get that. And again, big thank you to Smile for their continued support of the MacCast. So we need to follow up on a couple things from some of our past shows. One of the questions or issues that one of our listeners had was with barcodes and NFC readers. You may or may not remember we had a listener who had a barcode that was for a ticket that he had for an airplane shuttle. So it was something that emailed to him. It was just simply a barcode, and he had taken that, had clipped it out and put it onto his phone. I think he actually saved the PDF into his Dropbox and wanted to use that document when he was getting on the shuttle to scan in. And he brought it up. That was fine. But when he went to go scan it in, the barcode reader on the shuttle bus was also an NFC reader. And what happened there was that triggered his Apple Pay to go off. So every time he would try and scan the barcode, the Apple Pay interface would come up and he could never get the barcode scanned. And luckily, eventually the driver took pity on him and just let him on the bus. But it brought up the question, what do you do about this? And I did some testing and found out that if you're using Wallet, if that pass was able to be saved into the Wallet app, that seems to disable the NFC. But a number of you wrote in and said, well, what if you just put the iPhone into airplane mode? Wouldn't that disable all of the radios and then the NFC wouldn't trigger and then you could do the scan? Unfortunately, while that's a great idea, I tested this out and putting your iPhone into airplane mode does not disable NFC. So even in airplane mode, it will still trigger the Apple Pay interface to come up. But Vladdy wrote in, and he said he uses an app called Pass2U. That's Pass the number 2 and U. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at MacCast.com. And it is a free app, although it does have in-app purchase. And it has the ability to get these pass templates. And if you want to take advantage of that feature, you need to, one, purchase the app, and you also need to connect it to your Facebook account. And I believe this is because that's how the developer facilitates sharing of these pass templates. So you can go in if you have the paid version, and you can create a whole custom design and a custom template, and then you can share that out. And I believe they do the sharing through a Facebook app and Facebook accounts. So you can do that if you want, but you don't need it to do what Vladdy has recommended, which is just basically take a barcode in a photo or a PDF, or you can scan it right in with the app using the camera, or you can even type in the barcode, and you can use that to create a pass that you can add to your Apple Wallet. So it gets around this problem, because as you know, as I just told you, the wallet app, when it's open, disables the NFC, or the NFC will not trigger when the wallet app is open on the iPhone. So this app is totally free. It's cool because you can select the type of pass that you want to build, whether it be a ticket or a loyalty card or a boarding pass. And you can even do, even in the free app, some kind of basic design customization, like change the colors. You can add a logo to your pass and really make it look like your own. If you want to fully customize your design, you do have to pay the $1.99 in-app purchase and maybe connect it to Facebook. But I thought this was a great solution, and I played around with it a little bit. It wasn't perfect. It had a hard time, especially with the camera app, kind of finding barcodes, and even with a document that I had saved into Photos. So I had snapped a picture of a barcode and put it into Photos. It's supposed to automatically find and recognize the barcode. It didn't work every time, but at the very least, you had the ability to fall back and just type in the barcode, and you could add it that way. So it seems to be a pretty good solution, and it works almost as advertised. So barring anything else, any other solution, I don't know what else to give you. So if you run into this problem, if you want to create your own passes, check out Pass2U. And again, I'll have a link to it in the show notes at MacCast.com. Another thing that was brought up on a recent episode of the MacCast was using iTunes accounts in multiple countries. This came about because Apple in China has complied with some new regulations and rules that say that the data, the cloud storage data, needs to be managed by a Chinese company. So they've partnered with a Chinese company, and they're going to be migrating iCloud services in China over to them. And they're giving Chinese consumers and also non-Chinese citizens who are living in China the ability to opt out of Chinese iCloud and stick with Apple and go back to their country of origin. So some questions came up related to that. And Douglas says he's in Japan, and he has U.S. and Japanese accounts. And what he noted was that whenever he logs into either country's iTunes with the opposite country account, he's told he has to switch to the appropriate country. So if he's trying to log into his Japanese account, for example, with his U.S. iTunes, it will switch him over to the U.S. account. And he also noted that when he attempts to switch from, say, the Japanese store to the U.S. store after logging in, he'll even get a notice that says he needs to first cancel his Apple Music subscription to be able to switch over. So it kind of seems odd, because he uses his iCloud account, not his iTunes account, for Apple Music, and presumably the iCloud account wouldn't be tied to a specific country. But I'm not exactly sure that's true, because you use, I think, Douglas, your iTunes account to purchase your Apple Music subscription. If I log into my iTunes store account and go under the settings, manage subscriptions, what I can actually see is that my Apple Music membership is in there. So I think it's infinitely tied to your iTunes account, even if you use your iCloud account for initially setting it up. I think it all comes back to that purchase and what credit cards are linked to your iTunes account, and what country did those credit cards come from? And Douglas was wondering exactly the same thing, if somehow Apple was using the credit card on file to determine the country of origin. And I do believe, Douglas, that's exactly what's happening. So the question became, you know, could you possibly unlink the credit card, say, on the Chinese store and just switch to using the app stores in that way? So you move over to the country of origin app store, and then you still maintain your Chinese store account, but it's not tied to any credit cards. And that should work. I've actually been told by some people that that's exactly what they do to be able to make purchases in other countries. So, 'cause sometimes apps become available in only certain countries, and what they do is they use prepaid iTunes gift cards instead of credit cards to make their purchases. But even that gets complicated, because you do have to get a gift card from the country that has the iTunes account, and that can be pretty difficult to do. And it's actually something that I've always thought was really odd, because it means that if I want to buy a U.S. iTunes, or if I want to buy a gift card for iTunes here in the U.S. and send it to someone in the U.K., they can't use it. So it's sort of like I can't gift iTunes to people in other parts of the world. That's really weird. I don't know why Apple has that restriction and why they make it so difficult. But getting back to using iTunes in other countries, Douglas was able to confirm, because I had asked on the last episode of the MacCast, you know, what happens if you buy an app, say, in the Chinese store and you're logged into the US store and you need to do app updates, will you be able to update the app? And he says that works totally fine for him. All that happens when he's logged into one and it tries to update the app from the other store is it will pop up with the login dialog, and he has to put in the login credentials, rather, for that country's account. It doesn't even switch the accounts at that point. It just updates the app in the background. So that runs seamlessly. So again, for the folks in China, they could choose to keep that Chinese account, but that ends up being a dilemma, because if you don't agree with the Chinese company's policies, they're still taking over your iCloud data. And if you opt out, your iCloud account and data is actually an iTunes account, I think, are completely deleted. So at that point, you're only going to be left with the account in your country of origin. So, you know, I think bottom line with iTunes, when it comes to iTunes, is you kind of have to use it in whatever country you have a credit card for. And outside of that, you know, trying to find workarounds and sort of hackarounds for working with multiple stores just gets really complicated. It just seems like it's more trouble than it's worth, at least to me. And I appreciate Douglas and everybody who sent in feedback related to this. And then the last thing I want to talk about from past episodes is the whole battery replacement stuff. So if you have an old device and you think that your battery needs to be replaced, or you just want to go in and get a battery replacement from Apple, one thing you might consider doing before you do that, especially if you've gone in and checked your battery and it still checks out in the healthy range, but you still are like, well, it checks out healthy, but I'm still getting slow response and my iPhone's just running not all that well, consider the fact that sometimes I think your iOS device just needs a brain transplant. You know, as much as it sucks, a lot of you wrote in to say that you thought your older devices were suffering from shutdowns, but you did the checking, you looked in it, you were still in that 90 plus healthy battery range. And what a lot of you discovered was that just by simply doing a backup, erase, and restore of your iOS device, a lot of your problems went away. You know, I think sometimes iOS, because we do over-the-air update after over-the-air update and stuff like that, I think sometimes they just build up a little cruft. I don't want to go so far as to call it corruption, but they just lose their minds a little bit. And it's just kind of like you slap them around and reset them. And it is a really annoying thing to do. I admit, you know, I've had to do it a few times in the past, and it's never a fun experience. Although more recently, the last few times I've had to do a full backup, erase, and restore, it really hasn't been that bad. About the worst part is just the re-downloading of all the apps. But everything else is not too bad, especially if you do an encrypted backup in iTunes ahead of time. And I really recommend going that route. So if you know you're going to do an erase, a backup, erase, and restore, Make sure you connect your iOS device to iTunes. Go in there, go into the backups section, check on the box that says to encrypt the backup, and manually do a backup from iTunes. And the reason you want to do this is going to save stuff like your health data, your network configurations, your passwords, all these things you're not going to have to re-enter when you go back and restore. If you just rely on an iCloud backup or something like that, you're going to lose some of that data, and you're going to have to be spending a lot of time re-entering passwords and network configurations and stuff like that. And that is just a security thing. Apple will only restore that data if it has been protected and encrypted. It has to communicate that stuff back and forth because that's sensitive data. So that's what's going on. You're still going to have to reset things like your Face ID and your Touch ID. You're going to have to re-add your Apple Pay cards and stuff like that. So it doesn't get around all of the problems, but in my opinion, it does make that whole process a little less painless. And I think you'll find your iPhone will run better. So if you're not suffering purely from the battery thing, or you don't suspect it's the battery thing, I would give that a try. It's not the first thing I would try if I'm having trouble with my iOS device. You know, first try rebooting it, maybe try closing down apps just to make sure there's not some errant apps, although that's not likely to be the case. And then if you're still continuing to have problems, especially things like fast battery drain or just general, you know, things where it's running slow or locking up, consider doing a full restore and see if that doesn't help out. I also got a lot of follow-up on my whole conversation about maybe not always having to upgrade to the latest and greatest Apple products, sort of holding on to and keeping your own older gear a little bit longer. And I want to share you a story that I got. Nathan emailed me. He wrote in with his experience with upgrading his MacBook Pro, a 2009 model, which he had added some extra RAM to. He did an SSD upgrade, so it's been running really well for him. He didn't really want a replacement, but right before Christmas time, the keyboard on that 2009 MacBook Pro went out, and he thought, this is probably a sign that it's maybe time to upgrade. You know, it's pretty old. I've had this for a long time. It served me well. I'm going to go ahead and upgrade. And he ended up buying a refurbished Touch Bar MacBook Pro. And interestingly, he had the MacBook Pro that he purchased was specced out, at least in terms of the RAM and the SSD storage. It was specced out at the same level as his upgraded 2009 MacBook Pro. Yeah, you know, it's this whole thing where SSD storage is so expensive, it feels like we've kind of made this step backwards. So, you know, he didn't really get an upgrade there, but obviously he got a big upgrade in processor and Retina display and all that stuff. But in the end, he ended up deciding it wasn't for him. He decided to return the new MacBook Pro and stick with his old gear. And what it was for him was the loss of MagSafe was kind of a really big deal, he found out. He didn't like the feel of the new keyboard, and it does take some getting used to. Plus, it has, you know, a lot of the issues for a lot of people that we've talked about with the keyboard just going bad and being needing to be replaced. And he also wasn't enjoying, you know, Dongle Town with the MacBook Pro. He had other devices, so he's having to use USB-C breakout boxes and dongles and accessories. And just between all of that, he realized, you know, this machine just isn't right for me. You know, it's not a knock on the Touch Bar MacBook Pro. It's not to say that it's not right for a lot of people. But Nathan ultimately decided, you know, I don't really need this. I don't need this hassle. I'm not doing anything on this that my 2009 wasn't serving me well for. And he ended up returning it and finding a replacement keyboard on eBay for his 2009 for £15. He swapped it out himself, figured out how to do it, and he is now perfectly happy with his machine, and he's £1,800 richer because of it. And in the process, he also learned how to do a keyboard replacement on his old MacBook Pro. So he learned a new skill and is continuing to enjoy his machine, and hopefully they'll work out the kinks, Nathan, I think, on the newer MacBook Pros and switch up some of the offerings and listen to some of the consumer feedback. And, you know, that was kind of the whole point of this conversation, is that, you know, sometimes maybe the right move to make is, let me see if I can either upgrade what I have now, get it to the point where I can last another year till maybe Apple comes out with some newer models, something that interests me a little bit more, or maybe you buy just a used or refurbished model to kind of get you through the lean time before Apple really has a product that really excites you. And I think that's not a bad tact to take. And that was kind of what that whole conversation was about. So thank you, Nathan, for writing in and sharing your experience with us. And speaking of your experiences, that was something else that I asked you to kind of share with us. And I got a lot of great feedback from a number of you, including this feedback from Stefan.
Hello, Adam. It's Stefan here from Hong Kong. You may remember me a few weeks ago. I tweeted at you some statistics from my Apple Watch after swimming a few laps in the pool and how impressed I was with all the data it managed to gain from my arm movements alone. Anyway, that's related to a story I want to tell you about the replacement program for the iPhone, because I have an iPhone 6, and it was perfectly okay using iOS 10. And then when I got the Apple Watch 3, I was required to install iOS 11, which I was reluctant to do because I was worried about slowdowns and battery life. And sure enough, after I installed iOS 11, my battery life was terrible, and it just got worse and worse with every point upgrade. And, it would just last maybe 3 or 4 hours on a charge before I had to carry a battery with me everywhere, a spare battery. So when they announced the replacement program, I was quite excited, of course, and they originally said end of January, and then they changed it to, like, right now. So I signed up for an appointment on the website, a Genius appointment, and it was quite busy. You know, you could see all the different stores when the appointments were available, and some of them were a few days away, some of them were more than a week away. But I managed to get an appointment within, like, the next day, I think, at 5 p.m. to an Apple store, and I went in there, in Hong Kong this is, and it was pretty busy. Lots of people had the same idea. And they did a diagnostic test, and they didn't tell me the result of the test, but I was confident my phone was no good anymore in terms of the battery. And they said, okay, so we're going to have to find a battery to see if one is in stock for your phone model, which it was. And they said, oh, but we don't have enough manpower now to replace it, so because we've got so many people here. So they said, would you mind coming back another time and we'll reserve the battery for you? So I made an appointment for 11 a.m. the next day, and they kept the same battery for me. And I went in, and it was quiet. So, and they had people available to do the replacement for me. So that went well. They told me it would take 3 hours. They told me to come back at 2 p.m. So I went home. But after 45 minutes, I got an email to say my phone was ready. So that's quite annoying because I'd already got home. So anyway, I went back after a couple of hours, got my phone. Paid, I think, HK$228, which is almost exactly the same as the price in the States. And the phone is like a new device. It's just so great. The battery lasts like 23 hours with moderate use. It's like night and day, and I'm very happy. So I can keep my iPhone 6 going for a little while longer. That's it.
Hey, Stefan, thanks for sharing your experience with us. I think that actually sounds like it was pretty decent. I know a lot of people have been kind of struggling and having a hard time getting those battery replacements done. And what was interesting to me about your story is it's a little bit of the opposite of what I was recommending earlier for folks who maybe don't have a battery that is sort of being marked as bad, right? If you check your battery with iMazing or some of the other methods that we've covered here on the MacCast and you discover, hey, my battery is bad, then you absolutely want to get a replacement. And your story is similar to a number of other ones that I've received over the past week or two from other MacCast listeners, which is, hey, my battery was bad, and once I replaced it, wow, it is night and day. It's like a whole brand new device. And it's interesting to me that this Apple didn't want to sort of put this front and center when they knew that, wow, an old battery can create a really bad iPhone experience, whether it was the crashing or even just the slowing down of the device that Apple implemented to try and get around the whole crashing problem. Like, just the fact that the battery is bad caused a number of bad things to happen. So why wouldn't you really push hard to have people replace their batteries? And it seems like the right thing to do at this point, because like yourself, I have so many people that are just like, yeah, my new battery is, it's like night and day difference, just like you said in that story. So absolutely, if you find that your battery is older, if it's more than 2 or 3 years old and it tests out less than 80% of capacity, make that appointment. Call up Apple. Make sure you get in and get your battery replaced. Now, one thing I would really recommend if you're planning on doing this, and probably the best bit of advice I can give you, is you might want to start with, rather than just making a Genius Bar appointment and going into the Genius Bar, because very likely they're not going to have batteries in stock, you may want to start by calling up Apple over the phone or using chat support, because they can actually run the diagnostic test on your device completely remotely. It's pretty cool, actually, to watch if you've never done it. But they can take control of your phone. They can run all kinds of stuff and tests, and they can verify that you need a new battery. And then what they can do is they can pre-order the battery for you, have it shipped to the store where you're going to want to have the replacement done, and then it'll be there and ready for you. So the store will give you a call. You make the appointment, and at that point, you're making the appointment for the replacement. Just be sure when you talk to the chat agent or you're on the phone that you clearly ask and confirm that they are actually ordering the battery, sending it to the store, and that the appointment that you're going to make is for going in to actually install the battery. Because I have had a couple people who have said, I made the appointment, even over the phone, got in there, they retested my phone, found I needed a new battery, and then told me they had to order it and I had to come back later. You don't want that experience. You want to be able to go in and that day get your battery swapped. So I would do it that way, and be prepared when you go over the phone or go for chat, or even if you go into the Apple store, they are super backed up on these things, and it could be several weeks before you could even get a battery or an appointment for the replacement, depending upon your location. And not every location is the same, so it's going to vary depending upon your Apple store and how many people they have coming in and the quantity of batteries that they're being delivered and stuff like that. The other bit of advice I guess I would give in relation to this is, if you can wait, if you don't need a battery right away, wait. And I'm thinking about those of us who are like myself. I have an older device. Maybe it's right on the edge. It's not really running too slow. It's not really that big of a problem. Don't rush into the Apple store right now because they're so overloaded, because you're going to probably not have a great experience. Wait a few months, wait for things to die down, and I think it's going to be much easier to get a battery replacement. So if you don't need it right now, I think it's also just polite, you know, don't take the battery from someone who's really suffering and probably needs that battery right now. So thanks again, Stefan, for sharing your experience, and glad that things worked out very well for you. Another thing that we've commented on the show here quite a bit is AirPods. I've mentioned how much I love my AirPods. Well, I received this voicemail from Bill, and he had an experience with AirPods as well, and it maybe wasn't as good, but I think as you'll hear, it kind of all came out okay in the end.
Hi, Adam. Bill Murphy here. Just wanted to say, love the show. I'm calling from Mississauga, Ontario. It's just outside of Toronto. More well-known city. I just wanted to tout the quality of Apple's AirPods. I got an odd story that actually has an happy ending, so a bit crazy. So here in Canada, it's a little bit colder. Not as cold as most southerners think, but we had some really cold weather, like minus 30 Celsius, maybe minus 25 for about a good 2 week period there. So at Christmas time, I got a pair of AirPods, used them for a few days at relatives. When I got back to the city, I had to shovel the driveway, lost my AirPods. So I currently, at that time, only used the AirPods for about maybe 6 days. Loved them, was totally upset that they were lost. Great gift. My wife was upset that they were lost as well. Wasn't sure what to do. Waited about a week. After a few days, I overcome the fact that they were gone and just committed to the fact that they were gone. It was a very upsetting time. Then we had a weather change. It went up to 8 degrees. All the snow started to melt. And sure enough, I drove back and took a quick look around in the snowbanks where we looked earlier. And there they were, plain as sight, right there. Now, here's the best part. I figured I was going to have to put them in rice like you do with electronics after they get wet. to sort of dry them out, let it sit for a couple of days, but I didn't. I just picked them up, opened them up. The charging light came on. I felt they were damp, but they weren't wet. I took them inside. My iPhone had vibrated because earlier I checked their location on Find My iPhone, and the AirPods were in there. But the last known location was at my mother's place, and she looked around for them, didn't find them. So, of course, my phone vibrated when I did find them, and they connected to the phone instantly, and my phone vibrated, said the new location was at my house. So when I went inside, I put them in my ears right away, didn't dry them out, didn't put them in rice or anything. They worked fine. The battery indicated that the AirPods were at 100% charge, and the case was at 87% charge. This is after a week of sitting in minus 30, minus 25 Celsius, cold weather, cold, damp weather. Amazing products. Love the AirPods. I currently use them on all my iPad, iPhone, and even my Android box. The wife loves it because she doesn't hear the TV in the man cave anymore. Love the show. Keep up the work. Just a positive thing in a bad situation for great Apple products.
Hey, Bill, super happy that you were able to get your AirPods back and that they survived out in the extremities. Yeah, you know, I think Apple says that the AirPods themselves are splash resistant. They're not totally water resistant. I have to wonder if maybe yours survived a little bit better because they were in the case, and maybe that helped protect them a little bit. But I've heard other stories from folks who have gotten just an individual AirPod pretty wet, and it seems to survive that. So I have a feeling they're a little more waterproof than even Apple is willing to admit. And I think that's just mainly so people don't think they can go like swimming with them or something like that. But that is an amazing story. It made me think of a couple of things. One, the fact that for some reason, cold weather and snow seems to be the bane of the AirPods existence. I've mentioned that for me, you know, the AirPods don't fall out too easily. I have not had too many times when the AirPods fall out. I actually sleep in mine, and I will fall asleep and wake up the next morning and they'll still be in my ears. And it's not like I'm a immobile sleeper, you know. I roll and toss around just like anybody else. About the only time I've ever had them fall out is when they're in my ears and maybe I'm trying to put on a sweater or a hoodie that goes over your head. And I think that's why often they'll fall out for people who are in cold weather climates, right? Because you got all your bundles and your layers and you're putting on stuff. And I get a lot of stories from folks like that. And as a matter of fact, just this week, you were the second person to tell me a story about losing your AirPods in cold weather when you're out sort of working around the house. I had another listener who wrote in, Paul, and he had lost his AirPod while doing some work in the snow and the mud in his yard, or I think it might have been a construction site. And luckily for him, he was able to use the Find My iPhone app right then and there to find the AirPod. But same kind of situation. It had fallen into the dank, muddy, you know, mucky area, and he pulled it out and cleaned it off, and it was just fine. It worked just fine. So I totally concur with you that it is a completely amazing product all the way around. And I love the fact too that you can use it. I use mine with my Apple TV, but it's great that you can use it with, you know, your Android box and just through the Bluetooth get great sound. And even just as a standard Bluetooth, you know, hooking up regular Bluetooth without the W1 chip or anything like else like that, I found them to be some of the best Bluetooth headphones that I've ever used. Don't have connection issues, doesn't drop the connection and stuff like that. So I don't know how Apple does it, but I totally agree. Probably the best product Apple has made in the past few years, in my opinion, hands down. So if you're looking for a gift or something, you know, for an Apple fan in your life, AirPods are something you cannot go wrong with if they don't have a pair yet. So thanks for sharing your story. One last thing I just want to point out. I love the fact, one of my favorite things about doing the MacCast is the fact that we have such an awesome international community. You know, I get feedback from the US, of course, but also from Canada, the United Kingdom, Germany, Switzerland, Sweden, Japan, Taiwan, China, Australia, New Zealand, I mean, Africa, South Africa. You folks are in all corners of the globe, and it's just amazing to have that many people everywhere listening to the show. I'm totally humbled by it, and it's just an amazing thing. So thank you for tuning in and listening every week, and thank you for contributing and sending in your comments and your feedback. We have a little more of it in this show than we normally do in most episodes, but that was because I got a lot this week, so I had a lot I wanted to share with you. All right, one last thing before I let you go. I have a quick thing of the moment, and this may surprise some of you based on some earlier comments I've made about wireless charging on the iPhone, because it's actually a wireless charging pad. One of my favorite companies, if you listen to the show, you know I'm a big fan of Anker products. Well, recently there was a deal on Amazon for the Anker PowerPort wireless charging pad. And this is the older pad. I think they have, if you go to their website now, they have a couple of newer models, including a 10-watt fast charger. But this was just simply the 5-watt version. It's still available on Amazon. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at mattcast.com. Right now, the standard price is $17.99 US, but I was able to pick it up with a $5 discount. So I got these charging pads, and I ordered two because they were so cheap, for just $12.99 each. So I was able to get two for about $26 plus tax. And I have to say, you know, it's been great. Now, I know I knocked wireless charging, you know, saying that I don't know that it's all that more convenient than just plugging in a cable. And I actually still stick by that. You know, I wanted to test it out and see what it was like to use wireless charging on a day-to-day basis. I didn't want to spend too much money on a wireless charging pad, and these totally fit the bill. You know, I have docks also for my iPhones, and I think it's just as convenient to throw it on the charging pad as it is to drop it down in the dock when I am ready to go to bed or something like that. These are, you know, in defense of different kinds of wireless chargers, these are a little bit small, and they only have a single coil, so you do kind of have to hit the target, which may be factoring into my experience. But, you know, overall, it works fine. It works great, and it is kind of fun to do. I have to admit that. The fact that I don't have to plug in a cable is just kind of a novel thing. And I'm actually, unfortunately, really struggling to retrain my brain to use the pad versus to just drop it in on the docks. I probably need to move the docks away from the wireless chargers. Right now I have them next to each other, and that will probably break me of the habit. But I have to say, you know, even if you decide to spring for the 10-watt fast charger from Anker, it isn't even that much more expensive. I think they're $22.99 versus $17.99. It's still ultimately slower than using a cable plugged into like a 12-watt wall charger, but most of the time it really doesn't matter. If you think about the times that you're charging, you might either be doing just a quick top-up or you're setting it to charge overnight, and you don't really care if it's charging quickly or not. The point is it charged up when you get up in the morning, and these wireless chargers will work great for that. And the thing is at this low of a price point, I have to say, you can just buy a bunch and, you know, throw a bunch around the house for little iPhone top-up zones, you know, that you can kind of set up, and I think it works great. So, you know, it's a great option. Is it, like, infinitely better than dropping it in a dock or plugging into a cable? I still think no, but if you can get them on a great deal and a great product like this Anker PowerPort wireless charging pad, you know, I say go for it if you get a good deal. I mean, that's what I did, and I think they're great. So I would highly recommend them to anybody who has an iPhone 8, 8 Plus, or an iPhone 10 that can do the wireless charging. So that's my pick of the moment for this week. And with that, that's going to do it for this episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile. Check out PDF Pen, great for your end of year tax preparations. You can check out that product. Also get information on their other products like Text Expander and Disk Label. Also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and Text Expander for iOS. Get more information and details at smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You'll find them at BackbeatMedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. I'd love to hear your comments, questions about anything related to this episode or any other episode of the MacCast. You can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or if you'd prefer Google Plus, we do have a Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. But that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.